I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
What he's so pissed off about, it's only a horse head in his bed. It could have been a human head. ISIS could have put a human head in his bed, so what's he bitching for? But I guess the Godfather gave him an offer he couldn't refuse. How about that? Terrible Tommy here in the bunker right here in north central Indiana on a July 23rd, and it's Thursday here. One of my favorite words in a week. Thursday, yeah. I can just see Thor up there swinging that sword, chopping off all those politicians' heads in Washington. And then when he gets done there, he's going up to Wall Street and do it. Well, we got half a moon today, and tonight, half moon, that's right, on the Frank Silva Memorial Wall Clock here, the atomic wall clock that keeps perfect time right down to the fraction of a second. And I'm Terrible Tommy here, keeping track of the seconds in the underground lair. And, we also have a couple of jail cells down here. We still have Jerry the Jew. I bet you guys forgot about Jerry the Jew. He's still down here. We keep him alive. We just keep him alive enough, you know, we don't want him to die off on us. We pull him out every once in a while and Igor tortures him. What do you think about that? Hey, Jerry the Jew, are you back there?
Hey, let me out. Let me out. I gotta go to synagogue.
Oh, you can't go to synagogue, you dumbass. Ever since I got back from Israel, I've been waterboarding him a lot more than usual. Usually once every 2 days, but I've been waterboarding him every day now because I just got excited going over there to Israel. Came back, I'm taking it out on Jerry the Jew. Hey, when's that big debate coming up with old Trumpet and the Trumpites against the stalagmites? That's supposed to be on here pretty soon, one of these nights. That's going to sell more tickets than the Indy 500, I'll tell you that. Oh, I sent you out this big, long study of the white nationalists that somebody's put out. I don't know the fellow. In fact, I don't know most of the people, or at least I haven't met most of the people that he talks about in this. Sounds like there was one put out like this back in the early 70s, the DeGuello report that Willis Cardo was so frantic to find out who did it that he employed me. Well, I volunteered my time to go looking. He even opened up a P.O. box and put out a reward for who did it because he was so paranoid. The DeGuello report, of course, much of it was very true, and whoever wrote it knew exactly what was going on in the so-called right wing of the 60s and 70s. I thought it was sort of funny because Willis Cardo said, "It's all lies. It's all lies. They're lying about me." But I happen to know that most of it was true. I think I know who wrote it, but I never told anybody, I don't think. So now we get the same thing on in a more modernized version once in a while, where somebody that knows quite a bit about what's going on in the white nationalist movement comes on and writes up a bunch of stuff. And surely a lot of it's true. Some of it I don't know for sure, but I sent it to you anyhow for your perusal. But I told everybody, I said, you know, I've been out of the right wing since at least 25 years. They don't seem to understand that, so don't include me into your white nationalist situation, because I'm not a white nationalist. I'm a lone wolf and a racial separatist, and that's it. Yeah. I'm not a communist. I'm not a capitalist. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. I'm just one of those nasty-ass people that likes to tell the truth. And we all know that's illegal to tell the truth. Believe it or not, I was over to the garage this morning with my vehicle that they're going to do a little work on, and it was an old biker came in. You see these old bikers around? They still got hair clear down to their shoulders, but they're about 60 years old. And I was looking at the patches on his back. He had Jane Fonda as a bitch. Can't believe it. That was from way back in the late 60s and 70s. He's still sporting that Jane Fonda as a bitch. A hell of a lot of young people don't even know who Jane Fonda is. I see that they dedicated a street to her old hubby there, Ted Turner. That was yesterday, I believe, down in Atlanta, Georgia. They dedicated it. Street to Ted Turner. I always got a sort of a laugh out of this dedicating buildings and highways and all that bullshit to supposed heroes and all that kind of stuff. I don't give a shit if they ever name a highway off of me. That's crazy, man. You're dead. But you still got all these signs around the Ronald Reagan Highway. What a waste of time and money. Tried to record something. It's the funniest damn thing I've heard in a long time. It's a conversation between either a highway patrol or a city cop with a driver that's just giving him all kinds of shit. It's so funny. It's unbelievable. And how this cop remains absolutely, totally cool. I mean, you know, which cops normally can't do because, you know, they're in power. They got the laws on their side, so they can get pretty nasty. But this cop was so cool. This guy was coming at him with everything he could, and the cop just kept, "Yes, sir. Uh-huh. Okay." And if I can find it, I'm going to play it for you. I've never heard anything so funny. Well, I started this show once and screwed it up, so I'm starting again, and now I'm not sure quite where in the hell I was, but going forward to our Pessimist's Guide to History, we're going to go to the second big news of the millennium or whatever. 65 million years ago, well, that's before I was born, extinction of the dinosaurs. For 160 million years, dinosaurs roamed the earth, evolving into a multitude of species that could be found on land, in sea, and in the air, and on television, and in the movies. They survived the massive upheavals of primeval continents breaking up and shifting about the face of the earth. They just held on, all the while thriving in a climate that was much like a continuous temperate summer. Suddenly, 65 million years ago, they disappeared. About the same time flying saucers started coming around. The mystery of their abrupt extinction has left scientists baffled. There are numerous theories, of course, some of them postulated rather improbable causes. One theory holds that the dinosaurs may have died of constipation after eating newly evolved forms of plant life that they could not digest. Others suggest there might have been a change in climate or even a sudden burst of radiation from a not-too-distant supernova. Increasingly, though, the evidence points towards a cosmic catastrophe, sort of like Bush, George Jr., most likely a huge asteroid or comet that collided with the Earth. A layer of clay containing the heavy metal iridium, often found in asteroids, has been discovered in sites around the world, and in 1987, researchers located a 28-mile-wide crater in the floor of the Atlantic Ocean that's also rich in iridium, suggesting that the Earth was hit by a big asteroid at about the time of the dinosaur extinction. It could have ended that quickly. A fiery asteroid, 6 miles in diameter, falls out of the sky at 45,000 miles per hour, smashing into the Earth with tremendous force. Great clouds of debris explode up into the atmosphere, shrouding the Earth with darkness for months, and lowering, and we don't mean niggers, it's just, you know, regular darkness, and lowering temperatures on the surface enough to kill off a majority of plant life. Dinosaurs that fed on plants died first, while the carnivores succumbed soon afterwards. Well, that gives you a little idea who's going to make it the longest. Us carnivores. This may have been the Earth's first major ecological disaster. And that's the end of my reading from my Pessimist Guide to History Bible. We'll be back tomorrow with some more happy thoughts. Okay? Now, you know this guy that wrote this expose on white nationalism? I got to thinking. I didn't get to read every sentence. But I did get to thinking after thinking about it again the second time. He had all kinds of criticisms on what everybody's doing wrong, but I don't see anything in here to tell them to do right. In other words, if Roof shooting up a bunch of black people down in the Georgia church is wrong and bad, which probably is, then also on the other side, people just working on the internet, putting out information is bad. Well, what's in between? What the hell? I wish he'd come up with an afterthought about what do we do that's right, man? I always like to do that. Whenever I put out something negative, I try to put out something positive, even though the positive may be negative to a lot of people. That's right. I hope you understand that. I like to go up on Netflix once in a while to this Criterion Collection because it's got movies from all over the world, old movies, mostly older movies, but not real old movies, but mostly European movies and Asian movies. Well, I found one last night called The Pickpocket. And I really like this movie because I got to thinking the allegory of this pickpocket was Lone Wolf. There's nobody more lone wolf than a pickpocket. And it showed the excellent methods that he used to make a living by picking pockets. And I got to thinking, well, that's sort of like the lone wolf. We're around people all the time, but we're not necessarily with them. Not necessarily socializing with them or anything like that, but we move among the crowd like he moved them among people on the streetcar. And then he figured out a better way. It was to sit in a bank lobby and watch who draws out quite a bit of cash and then follow them out and pick their pocket. He did have a couple of guys once in a while worked with him, sort of like a three-wolf pack. And boy, they were good. So if you've got Netflix, going over there to that Criterion, or is it Roloff? I'm not sure now, but anyhow, the movie is French, and it's simply The Pickpocket. It's a very simple, basic movie. And this guy's a real classic lone wolf pickpocket. I loved it. Loved it. Yeah. I'm sort of strange that way. Now, boys and girls, we're going to get into a new book called Terror in the Night by Jack Nelson. Now, Jack Nelson was one of the best of the worst reporters. They're all worse, but Jack Nelson, I think, did a pretty fair job of keeping the facts, evidence separated from myths. So we're going to get into this Terror in the Night right now. It was evening, June the 29th, 1968. The sun was beginning to set, but the heat lingered under the trees and in the softened tar along the edges of the road. A dark green Buick Electra headed slowly along the south shore of the Ross Barnett Reservoir. Incidentally, Ross Barnett, the governor of Mississippi, sold out during the civil wrongs revolution, pretending to be fighting to the end, but he did not. Anyhow, the Ross Barnett Reservoir outside Jackson, Mississippi, which used to be the center of good Klan activity, according to Tom Metzger. Kathy Ainsworth sat quietly beside the driver. She was 26 years old, 5'4", and buxom, with pretty oval face and brown eyes that matched her thick brunette hair. If any of her friends had seen her, especially any of the teachers she worked with at the Lorena Dooling Elementary School, or the parents of her fifth grade pupils there, they might have been surprised at the way she was dressed. Tight fitting, high cut shorts, and a low cut jersey top were unusual attire for a quiet young school teacher going out for dinner on a Saturday night. But then, as her friends were soon to learn, there had been a good deal about Catherine Madeline Ainsworth they did not know. The driver, Thomas Albert Terrence III, was 21 years old. He had an air of confidence that set him apart. He was tall and trim, about 6'3" and 170 pounds, with brown eyes, black hair combed straight back. Women were attracted to him. Kathy had met Terrence in Mobile, Alabama in 1966 when she was Kathy Capomaccia, an Italian family. She later married Ralph Ainsworth, a health club operator, but she was drawn to Terrence because of the passionate views they shared and perhaps because of his daring. Terrence did what others only talked about. She had eventually become his partner in terrorism, and their relationship had evolved into romance. Terrence pulled the Buick into the dirt track that branched off from Shore Road. Another car was waiting in the quiet evening, and a muscular young man with a close-cropped brown hair was standing beside it. Terrence stopped and beside the second car and nodded to the young man, Danny Joe Hawkins. I'll have you know, boys and girls, I knew Danny Joe Hawkins personally and met with him when I was in the home of the head of the Knights of the White, the White Knights of Mississippi. Yeah, Danny Joe Hawkins. Quickly, Hawkins put a brown cardboard Clorox carton into the trunk of a Buick and handed Terrence a small, carefully wrapped package, which he gently placed on the front seat. Quote, "Are you sure you don't want me to go along?" Hawkins asked. "You might need an extra gun." "No," Terrence replied. "It's an easy operation." Terrence swung the Buick back on the main road and drove at a leisurely pace towards a restaurant called the Captain's Table. Hold on a second, I got a little problem here. Wait a minute. Which stood on the crest of the hill above a small inlet. At the restaurant, he and Kathy Ainsworth chose a table by a large window overlooking the water. The 27-mile-long reservoir lying just north of the Capitol was named for a man they both admired. As governor, Ross Barnett had made national headlines in 62 by defying a federal court order to desegregate the University of Mississippi. His action helped precipitate a riot that left two people dead, more than 100 U.S. Marshals injured, and the university campus in shambles. Barnett had been a hero to Terrence and Kathy ever since. Unfortunately, eventually he threw in the towel and made himself acceptable to the feds, just like George Wallace, just like the governor of Arkansas. They ordered steak and seafood outside the Sunset, turning the reservoir into a dazzling sheet of silver and red. Terrence and Kathy absorbed their plan, paid little attention. He reassured her that things would go smoothly as the last time they worked together. Their mission tonight would be in Meridian, a little more than 80 miles from Jackson. In the parlance of their master, Samuel Holloway Bowers, Jr., and that's who I said I met at the same time I did Hawkins. Actually, it was in Hawkins' mother's home, but Sam Bowers was there, too. In fact, I spent more time talking to Hawkins than I did with Sam Bowers, because Sam Bowers headed the White Knights of Mississippi, but at this point he was trying to integrate himself back into the Republican Party, and he was even talking about running for office, which Danny Hawkins, he looked at me and I looked at him, and we sort of winked at each other like, that's ridiculous. And he was the Imperial Wizard of the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. The mission was a number four, a murder. In Meridian, Detective Luke Scarborough was preparing to go back to work. "Vix, tonight's the night," he said to his wife. Lydia Victoria, she had made the same remark when his older brother Calvin had stopped by his house on the way home from an Army Reserve meeting. He had spoken the words without emotion. Vic and Calvin knew he was involved in undercover work that concerned a rash of church burnings and the bombings of Meridian Synagogue. Of course, remember, these churches were not this peaceful baby Jesus outfits that you think, at least some of the time. They were used as enemy centers of information and organization by the people who wanted to invade and take over the South. So the fact that these churches got burnt was only logical. They suspected something big was about to happen, but neither asked what he had meant. Vic thought it was better if she did not know, and Calvin knew his brother would clam up if he did ask. Scarborough was a devout Methodist, well, that was number one mistake, who valued his privacy and was secretive about his police work. He liked nothing better than to work his 30-acre patch of land outside of town, where he kept a cow and raised a good portion of the food that sustained his family. But he also thrived on the long hours he worked as a detective. His fellow officers admired him for his dedication and his courage. All had heard the Korean War story of how he and other Marines, although badly frostbitten, had fought their way out of the Chosun Reservoir after being cut off by North Korean troops, and they knew of the harrowing experiences he had endured as a detective, but not many of them knew about tonight's assignment. Mayor Davidson was, we lost 7,000 Marines at that Chosun Reservoir. 7,000 Marines, we never got the bones back. That was in the Korean War. Mayor Davis, well, they don't care. That's why it doesn't happen. They don't care any more than they care about getting all the remains back from Vietnam. At the same time, we're building giant electronic plants and putting hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of Vietnamese to work, while people in the United States are out of work. I hope people get the message sooner or later. Meyer Davison was being stubborn. His wife Frances was packing an overnight case as Meridian police officers and FBI agents in the living room and kitchen checked and rechecked their plans. But he would not budge. Davison was hard to reason with once he had made up his mind. He and his brother Sammy had taken their father's junk business and built it into the Southern Pipe Company, one of the largest distributors of plumbing supplies in the South. Meyer was president of the company, and two brothers were among Meridian's most prominent citizens. In a city that had risen, you got to remember something, Jackson, Mississippi, in the Bible, you know, in the belt of the Confederacy, the buckle of the Confederacy, always had a colony of Jews. Now, there's a book I have in my library I've read to you before that gives you all the background on those Jews in Jackson, Mississippi, that put up the money to assassinate these Klan members. In a city that had risen to wealth and prominence with the coming of the railroads in the 19th century, faded when rail transportation went into eclipse, the brothers stood out for their entrepreneurial energy. Let me remind you, Ulysses S. Grant was lodged and stationed in Jackson before the Civil War. And he was very friendly with the local Jews. All over town there were businesses that had been quietly backed by with Davison seed money. Those they had helped had repaid them for their faith and made them rich. In spite of that, Mayer clung to his old ways. Among other things, he had an embedded habit of personally paying the Southern Pipe Company's bills at the end of every month in order to get the discount for prompt payment. Seated at his desk in his pine-paneled den, a brown cardboard box of statements before him, he brushed aside his wife's entreaties and urgent warnings of the police. Finally, the police dispatched a car for Bill Reedy. Reedy and Davison were as close as two men could be without being homosexuals. As the hulking Irish lawyer once put it, he understood Davison, a short, pudgy figure with a brusque manner, and he understood the rage of Davison had aroused among the racial extremists. I call them racial heroes. The previous September, when the Jewish bombings had begun with the synagogue in Jackson, Davison had lashed out at the cowards who would go out at night and bomb a house of worship. Even while he is funneling money to the Anti-Defamation League and putting money into a cash reward for killing off Klan members. Though it was not his temple, he saw the bombing as an assault on all Jews. Well, don't they always? And that's the way we should feel about whites. And he was right. The white knights, convinced that Jews were driving force behind civil rights movement, and they were, had shifted their attacks from blacks to Jews, which was correct. It was widely known that Davison had helped raise the money to fight the white knights. Probably a lot of money came in from New York and all over the place. Two nights earlier, the police had had a tip that Davison's house would be attacked, and Reddy had insisted that Davison and his wife evacuate. Davison had reluctantly cooperated, but was furious when it turned out to be a false alarm. This time, Reddy escorted Frances out of the large brick ranch house to a car waiting in the broad driveway. Then he waited until Davison's attention was diverted, scooped up a box of bills, hustled it to the car, and told his friend, "You've got to go to the Holiday Inn. The police say they're on their way with a bomb this time. You've got to get out of here." Davison resisted. "It didn't come last time, and you don't know what the hell you're doing. I've got work to do." Reddy countered that he had made a reservation at the Holiday Inn, but merely for a room, but for a suite with a desk. Davison could finish paying the monthly bills there. Davison finally agreed to go, but only if he could take his favorite chair. Reddy loaded the chair into the car. A short time later, four men with rifles, pistols, and shotguns, all black, fanned out behind the trees and bushes of an embankment across the street from the Davidsons' darkened house. Several more police cars and three cars carrying FBI agents and a team of demolition experts arrived. More heavily armed men took up posts. FBI agents Frank Watts and Jack Rooker stationed themselves in a house on the top of the embankment that had been evacuated at the FBI's request. The FBI did that to us once, too, in Northern California when we had our first Aryan Fest. They took over a house where they could look right down on us, and they had us all right in their sights. And we were told straight out by these sons of bitches that if we as much as raised our arms, they would shoot us down. Those are the exact words of these federal assholes. Watts and Rucker, along with the detective Scarborough, were key players in the police operation. Also, they had persuaded the man most responsible for the operation, Chief Roy Gunn, to stay home. They respected Gunn as a tough, dedicated police officer, but considered him too emotional to have a direct hand in the night's action. Gunn had wanted to be there. Klansmen had repeatedly threatened him and his family, and he vowed to send them straight to hell where they belong. But the FBI knew of his uncontrollable temper and how it had flared one night a few weeks later, after police arrested a Klansman apparently intent on firing a shotgun into Gunn's house. Clad in pajamas and a bathrobe, the chief had rushed to the police station and held a cocked pistol to the Klansman's head, declaring, "I'm going to shoot you if you say you didn't do it, and I'm going to shoot you if you say you did." An FBI agent had stepped in and ordered, "Get him out of here before somebody gets killed," and the Klansman had been led away. The big Buick, back on the highway again, cruised towards Meridian. Tommy Terrence, checked the box of dynamite several times, more out of habit than concern. He didn't really believe anything could go wrong. He was an expert in explosives, a marksman capable of hitting a plastic milk jug at 100 yards with a machine gun, and a man used to operating in secret and alone. Ooh, lone wolf. Ordinary Klansmen might need the high and they got from blustering for each other at Klan rallies, but not Terrence. He never wore a sheet, never went to a Klan rally. Mixing with the rank and file he knew could bring him into contact with the FBI infiltrators and informants. See, this was an early lone wolf. He knew the score before the score was around. He began working with Kathy Ainsworth because he knew her to be well-trained and dedicated as he was. At her desk in the basement of Meridian City Hall, Marie Knowles, the secretary of the Detective Bureau, was trying to follow the scraps of conversation on the police radio. City Hall was a dignified marble building with a row of white columns in front. But police headquarters, located in the basement, was a series of windowless, poorly lighted, smoky rooms with low ceilings. In the bullpen, where Knowles and detectives had their desks, the floor was covered with cigarette burns. Beyond the bullpen, there were two small interrogation rooms, an identification room off to the side, a vault. In the vault were hundreds of pages and reports and other records kept by Knowles, including reports on Joyner's guerrillas and the black shirts, which she shielded from officers whom Gunn did not trust. Gunn had set up two teams to harass the Klan, a small one under Sergeant Lester Gigolo Joyner, and a larger one dressed in black shirts and trousers for its night operations. Knowles knew just about everything that was to know about the Meridian Police Department. A pretty, vivacious 27-year-old brunette, she was better educated and more articulate than the officers she worked with. She was the only woman in the detective bureau and was a confidant of some. She sat at the desk between Charlie Powell, a heavy drinker, who was the assistant. I had to shut down there for him. A little bit. We live in an older house from the early 60s, which is not ancient, but it's pretty old by today's standards, and the ceiling is not finished off in the bunker. And anybody doing a lot of stomping around cramps my style down here. So, but my significant other, whenever someone comes to visit, which we're expecting a visitor, goes absolutely bonkers about cleaning. I don't know how your lady is, if you've got a lady, but I don't believe in that kind of stuff. I believe in straightening up the obvious trash cleanup and like that. But many women go absolutely berserk about cleaning when a guest is coming. Anyhow, I'm sort of old-fashioned about that. What you see is what you get. We left off talking about this female detective who really liked police work there in Jackson Police Department. Got a lot of thrill out of it. She had come gradually to thrive on the excitement of police work, but the strain had risen dramatically since the business with the White Knights began. Well, I would say since the business with the federal government and the Yankees and the niggers began. I don't think the White Knights were doing anything before that. Didn't need to. Department members hounded her constantly about the records of the black shirts. It's interesting they call a group of cops black shirts. Some hoped to pass on information to the Klan. Others resented the black shirts' overtime pay and suspected that their real purpose was to spy for Gunn, the sheriff, and to catch their colleagues in improper activities. Tonight, glued to the police radio, Mrs. Knowles resented the interruption when a police patrol brought in a man who had just killed another man with a wooden plank. There was nobody else available, so she had to inform the prisoner of his right to remain silent and to have a lawyer present. Then she took his statement, confessing to the killing. Stupid guy. The calls from Alma Powell, the wife of the assistant chief, Charlie Powell, one of the officers assigned to the Davison stakeout, were even more distracted. Alma was worried. Quote, "I know a lot more than you think I do about what's going on down here," she kept saying. "I want to know if my husband is safe." Marie Knowles did not know the answer to Alma's question, but one thing she did know for certain, the Knight Riders were not supposed to leave alive. 1 year before Terrence Meridian Mission in the summer of 67, he had knocked at the door of the Sambo Amusement Company in Laurel, Mississippi, looking for Sam Bowers. The dirty, dilapidated building, badly in need of a coat of paint, was located across the road from the ugly sprawl of the Masonite Corporation plant. I can imagine what the lungs looked like of the people who worked in that plant. Little more than an oversized shotgun house, it served as home to Bowers as an office for his coin machine business and as headquarters for the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, actually White Knights of Mississippi. Thomas Albert Terrence introduced himself. He'd come to enlist in the Imperial Wizard's Crusade. Bowers listened, but he was not the kind of man who welcomed anyone into his confidence quickly. Smart man. That's why he lasted so long. Terrence explained that he was applying for a job at Masonite, a multi-million-dollar manufacturer of fiberboard and other building products. The Masonite's plant regular workforce was on strike, and the company was recruiting new workers, strike breakers. Aren't they always? But the real attraction of Laurel was the opportunity for working with Bowers in the White Knights. Terrence considered the 43-year-old Imperial Wizard a highly intelligent, strategic thinker. Now remember, Sam Bowers, you'll probably talk about this later on, Sam Bowers graduated from the University of Southern California, one of the big universities out there, UCLA, and he attended Marxist meetings and so forth, which a lot of people tried to use against him. No, he was studying tactics. you study everybody if you want to study all their tactics. Because the Marxists had great tactics for organizing secretly and all that kind of stuff. That was the only way they could survive with the federal and local police on their ass all the time. Which there was no need to shut down the Communist Party of the United States. That was ridiculous. That was just propaganda. It was not very big. It was not going to go big. And they had no chance in hell of overthrowing the government of the United States. It caused a hell of a lot more trouble by persecuting them than it had if they had just left them alone. He was also drawn to Bowers because the Klan was known for its willingness to act, not just talk. Terence compared himself to Arab terrorists, so committed to their cause that they believed their chosen ends justified any means. That's interesting. I don't remember reading that before. Suspicious as Bowers was, Terence began to strike a responsive chord. The young man was talking passionately about the Jews and their role as instigators of the civil rights agitation that had thrown Mississippi for a turmoil. Well, there's nothing untruthful about that. The Jews were up to their ass in it, up to their neck. The same idea had come to dominate Bowers' own thinking that summer. It was not the blacks who threatened all he held dear, but the Jews who were manipulating the blacks. And Terence had disappeared, or had appeared at a time when Bowers was besieged and the White Knights were reeling. The previous February, Bowers and 17 of his followers had been indicted on federal charges springing from the murders of three civil rights workers in Philadelphia. In addition, he and 13 other White Knights had been indicted on state and federal charges in the death of Vernon Dahmer, the Hattiesburg NAACP leader. And it had become clear that the FBI, under the pressure to stop the violence, was using a network of informants that threatened to paralyze the Klan. A less committed person might be reconsidering his course, not Bowers. He was settling on new targets and groping for new means of attack. The tall, slim young man standing in front of him might be the instrument he was looking for, unless, of course, he had been sent by the famous but incompetent. Terence had used Bowers, could see Bowers was suspicious, as he should be. He expected nothing less. But Terence had a way of winning people over, and he set out on a shrewd campaign to gain the Klan leader's confidence. Terence had grown up in a middle-class neighborhood in Mobile, Alabama. His father was a used car salesman who had a reputation as a hot-tempered segregationist. In his teens, the younger Terence became fascinated with guns and right-wing politics. At Murphy High School, he ranted about the threat of the communist invasion of the United States. In 1963, when Murphy High desegregated under federal court order, hundreds of the school's 2,000 students, egged on by Terence, engaged in a violent demonstration. They ran wild, raced around the police lines, tore down the fences, wrecked the school grounds while his father watched. Terence led the students in shouting, 2, 4, 6, 8, hell no, we won't integrate. He was one of the 54 students arrested and charged with disorderly conduct. In 1964, his junior year, Terence dropped out to devote full time to working with right-wing groups that preached hatred of blacks and Jews. Sure. In other words, defense of whites. He came under the influence of Robert M. Smith, mobile director of J.B. Stoner's National States Rights Party, my good friend, and John Cromlin, a retired Navy admiral with a long record as a virulent anti-Semite. Yeah, I met John several times, Cromlin, and J.B. Stoner, of course, many times. Now they both passed away, but they did. They were a credit to the racial cause. Terence, you know, J.B. Stoner really taught me how to relearn the word nigger. Because I just never used it as a kid. Nobody used it around here, and there were no niggers around the county at all, so you didn't use the word. But J.B. Stoner, boy, I'll tell you, he used it all the time, and at first I was embarrassed all the time by, you know, thinking he was just an old Southern racist, but I began to learn after a while that he was right. We can't respect a race that's dragging us down, and you can't respect a race that's not equal, and you can't respect a race that half of your race is trying to say they're equal. Terrence visited Smith frequently in his mobile office in Cromlin at his large estate, not far from Montgomery, for long sessions on the communist Jewish threat. Of course, Duke got to Cromlin too in the mid-70s, early 70s. And of course, he used Cromlin too, like he uses everybody. He began making threatening calls to civil rights leaders and two rabbis and the head of the Anti-Defamation League in Mobile. With several other young right-wing radicals, he formed the Christian Military Defense League, a group that hatched bizarre schemes that Terrence later said ranged from distributing dismembered body of a key black leader around the black community to setting out booby traps in the black communities of Mobile. Alabama. Both of this, you know, that's interesting because Reverend Butler and Colonel Gale and Reverend Bertrand L. Comperé put together what they called the Christian Defense League about the same time. None of the schemes was known to have been carried out, but beginning in August of 64, Terrence's fascination with guns and terrorism, I call it guerrilla warfare, got him into a series of scrapes with the law. If you don't like what somebody's doing, they're a terrorist. If you like what they're doing, they're a hero and a guerrilla fighter. Police in Pritchard, Alabama, a small town north of Mobile, seized an automatic shotgun from him after he got into a fight with a black service station operator, but no charges were pressed. The next time he was stopped by police, he and Robert Smith were driving through a black neighborhood in Mobile, Alabama. Police seized a .38 caliber revolver and a sawed-off shotgun and charged Terrence with possession of an illegal weapon. Only if it was sawed off too much. As long as they're at least 18 and a half inches, the barrel, you're okay. That's what was wrong with that operation up there in Idaho, with what's his name allowing these guys, agents, to saw off his shotguns. And all he had to say was just going to saw them off, make sure they're not any shorter than 18 and a half inches. He'd had no problem at all. But he let him saw him off maybe to 18 inches or any fraction of that. Then they can charge you. He pleaded guilty to the weapons charge in federal court. Now, it's interesting. Indiana just passed a law that you can have extremely short shotgun barrels, which doesn't make any sense to me. They're worried about all this crime and hold up and burglary and all that shit, and they're allowing these short-barreled, I mean, you know, like 1 foot long barreled shotguns that guys can carry around under their coats and stuff, and you know, all the whole lot of the niggers do that, and the black Ku Klux Klan. I can't figure out, other than the fact that somebody in the State House liked the manufacturer and wanted to make them a lot of money, because every crook in the country is going to want one. He pleaded guilty to the weapons charge in the federal court in Mobile, and Judge Daniel Thompson let him off with probated sentence, but the judge warned him about the bad company he had been keeping and declared, "If I ever hear of you with a gun again, even a shotgun going dove hunting, I will revoke your probation." Terrence saw himself as something far different from an ordinary Klansman, and he was. He had a theoretical framework, a belief in an all-embracing international communist Jewish conspiracy. In his own eyes, at least, he had come to Laurel, a professional radical, a terrorist prepared, even eager, to make personal sacrifices for his cause. Now remember, the Communist International had programs to undermine the race, white race in this country. There's no doubt about it. Soviet Principle 10. And I talked to the black communist agents, that ex-communist agents, who had been given the job of doing all this stuff. It wasn't just my imagination of reading a book or listening to George Zinkin Rockwell. I talked to the actual black conspirators that were working for the Soviet Union. And they were doing all this stuff. And yet the left wing will still, mostly left wing, will still deny it, that it even happened. You never hear them talking about it. By the beginning of August 1967, Terrence had a job as a maintenance worker at the Masonite plant and a nondescript place to live not far from Bowers. Terrence stayed away from Bowers' house to avoid being linked to the Klan leader, but the two would meet at by prearrangement in out-of-the-way places to talk, which was very smart, and you should remember that. Then in September, Terrence did something that banished any remaining doubts Bowers might have had. He suggested it would be a good idea for Bowers to have an alibi for himself on a certain evening, a little later in the month, when Terrence planned a major strike against the Jews of Jackson, Mississippi. Afterwards, Terrence knew Bowers would be confident that he was not an FBI plant. Bowers, like Terrence, liked to think of himself as an intellectual. Well, he was very smart. I spent an afternoon with Sam Bowers, and he was very sharp, that guy, with a southern drawl. A slim figure with high cheekbones, heavily lidded hazel eyes, and long sandy hair combed to the sides, Bowers was thought odd even by his friends. He related to people almost solely on the basis of ideology. He was a bachelor who never had much use for women. Before joining the Klan, Bowers had had only one run-in with the law, an arrest in 1955 for illegal possession of liquor. He pleaded guilty and was fined $100. It was an odd charge for Bowers, who has never known to smoke or drink. He always said he didn't want to be a slave to any habit, his mother said. Instead, he became a slave to an idea, the idea of an international communist conspiracy masterminded by the Jews. He believed that the Kremlin was merely a front for a cabal of Jews attempting to bring down Christians, or you should say whites, throughout the world. In the United States, their chosen vehicle was the civil rights movement. It sure was. Yeah, well, Robert Welch of the John Birch Society had us looking under every bed for a communist. These other Jews were allowing the blacks to take over, or at least get out of line, using the communists as their agents. The Jews sought to destroy white society by mongrelization. Well, they sure have done a good job of that. In 1955, the Yuri was arrested for illegal possession of liquor. Bowers joined the original Knights of the Ku Klux Klan of Louisiana after the group spread across the Mississippi River and established a clavern in Natchez. By the early 1960s, with the civil rights movement growing stronger and more insistent, Bowers concluded that the original Knights were too passive. On February the 15th, 64, at a meeting in Brookhaven, Mississippi, he convinced about 200 members in the original Knights to defect and join a highly secret clan he was forming that would not hesitate to use physical force. An imperial wizard of the new clan, the White Knights, Bowers adopted a code of strict secrecy and set out as its goal the preservation of white supremacy, regardless of the cost and with the use of force and violence when considered necessary. A persuasive talker with an exceptional organizational ability, Bowers was an instant hit with the kind of people who made up the rank and file of Klan organizations everywhere in the South: school dropouts, unskilled and semi-schooled laborers, and other lower-income whites who feared blacks and the civil rights movement by economic as well as social reasons. I don't think they feared blacks as physical individuals. They feared the encroachment of millions of blacks overrunning society. Bowers was also recruited scores of individuals from his preferred target groups, and law enforcement officers, jackleg preachers, ragtag attorneys, and other professionals and semi-professionals who enjoyed a measure of respect in their communities. He could get these people to do damn near anything, said the state investigator who kept tabs on him. Lone wolves he was setting up all over the state, all over the South. As he bent them to his purposes, Bowers considered himself superior to his followers in almost every way. The typical Mississippi redneck, he said, doesn't have sense enough to know what he's doing. I have to use him for my own cause and direct his every action to fit my plan. Bowers established his headquarters in Laurel, a small city of 27,000, in the mid-60s, many of Laurel's whites who constituted about 65% of the population. Isn't that something? In the mid-60s, there was only 65% of the population was white. Became enraged when Masonite, the town's largest employers, began trying to implement the equal opportunity rules required by the government contractors. Laurel was fertile ground for Bowers' message because white workers were going to lose out. He sought to intimidate all who did not support him, and his passion for secrecy added to the white knight's frightening aura. He scared the citizens of Laurel. Well, if respect won't do it, fear does have to do it. They were leery of talking about him or the Klan because, as the local businessman said, quote, we never know who we might be talking to. And that was the power of the Klan. That was the great power of the Klan. You don't know who all the members are. The Laurel Leader Call newspaper considered the Klan too dangerous to write about. That's power right there. Yeah, they won't let my letters into the paper here, but in those days they would have let us write the articles ourselves. Even that was not good enough for Bowers. In 1964, the Leader Call was bombed. Later he sent word to the editor that the bombing was not for anything you did to us, but because you didn't do anything for us. I like that. Not for anything you did to us, but because you didn't do anything for us. I think that's a very important, I'm going to mark that, because that's a very important piece of logic. By the end of 1965, the FBI estimated that the White Knights had grown to a membership of between 5,000 and 6,000. True to Bowers' promise, it preferred covert action, shunning the parades, rituals, and other public displays that many clans promoted. And that's all they promoted. His clan, as Bowers wrote in one of his internal memoranda, was a nocturnal organization that works best at night. We must remember that the communists who are directing the agitators want us to engage in pitched battles in the streets so they can declare martial law. Well, that was true. They want you to go out in the streets. And I mean, I played that game for a long time. I finally figured out it was a losing deal and we were playing into their hands. It's what they don't know that scares them. As Christians, he wrote in an executive order, we are disposed to kindness, generosity, affection, and humility of our dealings with others. As militants, we are disposed to use physical force against our enemies. How can we reconcile these two apparently contradictory philosophies? The answer, of course, is to purge malice, bitterness, and vengeance from our hearts. Well, I think that's where he tried to play both sides of the fence. And I don't know, I guess he may have felt he had to play the Christian game. That's where you can't cut it down the middle. You got to go one way or the other. Period. Only the imperial wizard could order a number four, a murder. But that, too, could be done in the name of Christianity. Well, it should be done in the name of the white race. And forget Christianity. If it is necessary to eliminate someone, it should be done with no malice, in complete silence, and in a manner of a Christian act. See, this is where I get off the boat with this. I don't believe that Bowers believed this. I believe he only used it because he was surrounded by Christ's insanity. In 1964, with Freedom Summer looming, Bowers launched his organization on the equivalent of a holy war. In a chilling executive order, he called for counterattacks against selected individuals. which he shouldn't have had to done. It should have been just by knowledge of what had to be done. Within a matter of months, Charles Eddie Moore, Henry Hezekiah D., Michael Schwerner, James Cheney, and Andrew Goodman were dead. Well, they were soldiers from the North invading the South. Or if they were from the South, they were traitors to the South, the White South. So, what do you expect? Then a year and a half later, the White Knights turned to Vernon Domner, who had drawn Bowers' rage by working successfully to help blacks register to vote. Well, when you consider that, like the one town of Laurel there, where only 65% of the people were white, of course they were worried about blacks registering, because if enough blacks registered, they could control what was going on. And you don't want the blacks controlling what's going on. I'm trying to imagine if Warsaw here had been 65%, only 65% white when I was a kid. God, that would have been horrible. I'd have learned to say nigger a lot sooner. On January 10th, 66, shortly after midnight, two carloads of Klansmen drove from Laurel to the Kelly Settlement, raked the front of Dahmer's brick and frame house and his nearby grocery store with shotgun fire, and set the buildings ablaze with Molotov cocktails. Dahmer's wife and three of his seven children, four sons, were away in the armed forces. Were at home. Dahmer helped them escape through the rear of the house and remained behind him to fend off the attackers, firing a shotgun through the wall of flames that engulfed the front of the house. Dahmer was terribly burned, his lungs seared with smoke and flames. He died in the Hattiesburg Hospital several hours later. Well, he was a hero to the northern carpetbaggers, to the race mixers. And that's it. He was no hero to the salvation of the white race. He may have been a brave man. He may have been a halfway decent man. But he was trying to kill the white race. It was Bowers who had ordered the Dahmer house he burned and that he killed, if any way possible, according to testimony by T. Weber Rogers, who quit the White Knights after the attack on Dahmer. And you always get a falling away after something like this. Every time we had a big action or were involved in a big riot in the streets, we'd lose people. You'd think it would attract people, but it doesn't. A lot of the people who are think they were really committed to the racial idea, when it really comes down to the wire, are not that committed, and it scares the shit out of them. Rogers testified that when the Klansmen seemed slow to carry out Bowers' orders, the Imperial Wizard would pound on the table and say he was tired of fooling around. Something's got to be done about that damn nigger down south. If Bowers had silenced another voice in the civil rights movement, he would pay a high price. Vernon Dahmer's murder brought a massive response from the famous but incompetent. In other words, the Jewish Defense League. They call it the FBI. When Roy Moore, the special agent in charge of the Jackson FBI office, heard a radio report that Dahmer had been fatally injured, he telephoned the FBI office in Hattiesburg. "Reserve me a dozen rooms at the Holiday Inn and get me some office space," he ordered. "We'll be setting up." Every day and every night for 76 straight days, except for 3 days when he was visiting his home in Jackson, Moore drove his men in Hattiesburg to exhaustion. "We're going to get the bastards who did this," he told them. This was more pride of the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover than had to do with giving, really caring about the Negroes. Finally, Moore obtained arrest warrants charging Bowers and 13 other Klansmen with civil rights violations. All white juries tried Bowers 3 times in the Dahmer case. Hung juries resulted in mistrials 2 times in federal civil rights cases and 1 in a state murder case. That was a time when people, they might not be in your organization, they might not be a member of the Klan, but they did more good work by being on the juries and letting Klansmen go. Jury nullification, something that finally the Negroes figured out in the in that case of the Negro out west who now is sitting in prison up there in Las Vegas. His name escapes me for the minute, but that, you know who he is. But the FBI's tactics in relentless investigating the case, coming on top of the Philadelphia investigation and the massive campaign against the Klan all across Mississippi, with decimating the ranks of the White Knights, yes, chasing off the cowards and those that were afraid to get involved in heavy action. It was at this juncture that the Justice Department preparing to try Bowers and 17 others in the Philadelphia case that Terrence had shown up in Laurel. The new Klan campaign of violence, Bowers and Terrence agreed, would focus on the Jews, and what better to signal a shift in strategy than to bomb the new synagogue in Jackson. Terrence felt exhilarated at the way things were going. He was gaining Bowers' confidence, and he had paired up with Kathy Ainsworth. She was with him as he drove through the darkened streets of Jackson on September 18, 1967. Their mission that night would seal Terrence's relationship with Bowers. To Bowers, Terrence and Ainsworth seemed the perfect instruments, and not only because they were prepared to take violent action, the White Knights had other members willing to do that. What made these two special was they operated in such secrecy that the FBI and police knew almost nothing about them. Lone wolves. Ainsworth, linked to Terrence, was not known by anyone outside Bowers' tight inner circle. In their personal backgrounds, in their right-wing radicalism, and in their associates, Kathy and Tommy were a different species from the Klan members the FBI and local police were focusing on. The lawman's formidable network of informants would be of little help. In Ainsworth's case, even most of her friends had no inkling of her extremist beliefs. In Miami, where she grew up, Aidan Taft, the highly respected religion editor of the Miami Herald, was so close to her that she sometimes babysat for his two daughters. To him, she was a personification of sweet, an ideal girl from all we knew, the kind of girl we had long told our daughters we would like them to grow up to be like. Neither Taft nor Ainsworth's colleagues at Dueling Elementary School were aware of her activities with the Klan and the Americans for the Preservation of the White Race. It never occurred to them that she kept stacks of propaganda in her bedroom dresser, including a tract that warned about the thousands of white women and girls who have already been raped in their own beds by invading Negroes, and the thousands of women and young girls who have been made dope addicts for the specific purpose of moral debauchery and mongrelization, to be their willing slaves for the sex orgies, lust, and disease filth, unquote. And no one outside Bowers' inner circle knew that on the makeshift firing ranges in the woods outside Jackson, she was becoming proficient with a variety of weapons, including two kinds of submachine guns, or that she had been learning to make bombs and made teaming up with Terrence. It was after 10 p.m. on September 18, 1967, that there was almost no traffic. Sheets of ground fog cloaked the lawns and the trees of the sleeping neighborhoods as they approached their goal, the great soaring roof of the Jackson's Temple Beth Israel Synagogue loomed up. Terrence pulled to a stop nearby and turned off the headlights. They sat silently in the car for a few minutes. All was quiet. The device on the seat between them was simplicity itself. Sticks of dynamite bundled together with a blasting cap and a 15-minute length of common fuse. It would leave no clues. Terrence took the bomb under his arm and moved quickly across the lawn to the synagogue. He kneeled for a moment beside a wall. The cigarette lighter flared briefly. He hurried back to the car. Kathy swung the door open and they drove slowly away. As they reached the outskirts of Jackson, they heard the bomb explode. And that's it for today, boys and girls. I'll be back with you, tomorrow's Friday, if possible. If not, we'll get back to this book probably the first of the week. But who knows, maybe tomorrow. 14.5, and I think you're going to enjoy this reading because it really tells pretty much the whole story, And the interesting fact is that I knew so many of these people personally, not on a daily basis because they lived in Mississippi and I lived in Southern California, but having gone there and met with these people and seeing what good people they were and how dedicated they were, I was very impressed.
Riding north on Interstate 75 with a nervous fading beauty sitting by his side and a pistol that he used to pave the way down the long black stretches of a dark highway. Ray bought his future with a pound of lead, then he robbed him, left the store and left the clerk dead. That kid should have put the money in the sack, but he didn't, and now there ain't no turning back. He's a Jesse Ryder, he's a Jesse James. The best that he can hope for is a household name. There ain't nobody that a man can trust when all his headlines read notorious. He's rubbing the lights off to avoid the roadblock. Ray killed the motor at the county line. Changed his Tennessee plates to a lost tag sign. She could never ask what the boy had done, but she said she'd be his hostage if he needed one. Her mama raised her to be loyal and true, and she figured that's the least that she could do. She was alone and lonely on the midnight ride, reluctant Bonnie to a poor man's side. It ain't too easy when the man you love has got a reputation that's notorious. When the lights flashed on and the siren started howling like hellhound dog, Rick popped that Firebird into overdrive, swore he'd never let them take him alive. He was a desperate rider, he was Jesse James. The best he ever hoped for was a household name. The morning papers didn't say too much, but